You're listening to a Franciscan Voice podcast, your voice for all things good.
Ave Maria, my name is Brother Slanis Murray from the Wexford Friary. In Camden Row, just off Camden Street, in the busy city centre of Dublin, there is a graveyard, St. Kevin's Graveyard, which is now part of a small public park. I've known the place since I was a small boy, having grown up in the area. In this graveyard lie the remains of an archbishop, one who was martyred for the faith during the Elizabethan persecution. His name was Dermot O'Hurley, and this is his story. Dermot O'Hurley was born in Lycadoon near Limerick. We do not know exactly what year he was born. Both of his parents were of noble stock. His father owned and worked the estate of Lycadoon, and his mother was an O'Brien, and a descendant of the Earl of Thomond. His father also held the office of a steward for the Earl of Desmond, James Fitzgerald, the chief member of the Irish nobility in the area. Dermot was sent to Louvain for his education, where, it seems, he excelled. He obtained degrees in both theology and canon law, and later taught these subjects at Louvain, Rheims and Lille. It was not long before his learning and piety came to the notice of the ecclesiastical authorities, and on the 11th of September 1581, he was appointed by Pope Gregory XIII to the See of Cashel, one of the four archdioceses in Ireland. Interestingly, it seems that he was ordained to the episcopacy without having first been ordained a priest, something that does not happen very often. St. Ambrose is another example of such a case. The newly appointed Archbishop of Cashel set about making plans to return to Ireland, to take charge of his diocese. Listeners should remember that the period in which we are talking about was right in the middle of the reign of Elizabeth I, Queen of England, and England was the occupying power in Ireland at the time. Catholicism was effectively outlawed in both countries under the draconian penal laws. Thus, the Archbishop's return to Ireland would be fraught with danger. In Brittany, France, the Archbishop embarked on a sailing vessel bound for Drogheda in County Louth. He disembarked at Skerries, north of Dublin, and made his way up to Drogheda. At one of the inns in which he stayed, en route to Drogheda, a discussion on religion developed, and the Archbishop became involved in it. His defence of the faith came to the notice of one party to the discussion. This man, a Protestant, began to insult the Archbishop and then rushed off to Dublin to report him to the government authorities. However, a good person by the name of Dillon secretly warned the Archbishop of the danger he was in and advised him to leave town. Unfortunately, the same Dillon was arrested not long afterwards and suffered a long imprisonment. Indeed, he would have been executed if it were not for the intervention of his brother, who was a member of Elizabeth's Privy Council. The Archbishop and his guide set out for the town of Slane, County Meath, to the residence of Thomas Fleming, the Baron of Slane. There they stayed secretly for a few days, hoping that things outside would quieten down. When the Archbishop thought he was free from any danger, he began to act more freely, entering into conversation with guests who came to visit the Baron's house. One day, Robert Dillon, a member of the Privy Council, came to the house. A discussion on an important topic developed at the table, and the learned answers given by the Archbishop raised suspicion in the eyes of the Privy Councillor. He brought his suspicions before a meeting of the council, and the Archbishop was summoned to appear before them. However, the Archbishop had fled in the meantime. The members of the council questioned the baron and threatened him with severe penalties unless he brought them to the archbishop. The baron of Slane, who was not very strong in his faith, set out to look for the archbishop and caught up with him in present-day Carrick-on-Shore in County Tipperary. The archbishop had been returning from a pilgrimage in nearby Holy Cross Abbey to venerate the famous relic of the True Cross. This was in fulfilment of a vow he had made during his sea voyage, when there had been a danger of shipwreck. The baron addressed the archbishop in a civil manner and suggested to him that he should return and appear before the Privy Council to prove his innocence. As the archbishop did not wish the baron to suffer any adverse consequences, he agreed to return with him to Dublin. Thomas Butler, the Earl of Ormond, was in Carrick-on-Shore at the time. Butler had a great reverence for the archbishop and arranged for food and necessities to be brought to him secretly. On a journey back to Dublin, the archbishop was detained overnight in jails, whilst the baron stayed at inns or with friends. In Kilkenny, some Catholics paid a visit to the archbishop. The recent case of Peter Power, the Bishop of Ferns, came up for discussion. Sadly, Bishop Power, in a moment of weakness, had abandoned the faith. Archbishop O'Hurley remarked to his visitors, "There are many who are lions before the fight, yet are found to be timid as deer in the fight. I humbly implore our good Lord that the like may not happen to me. For he who thinks he stands, let him take care lest he fall." As an aside, we are happy to relate that Bishop Power did repent of his weakness 4 days later and was cast into prison. He died a few years later in Compostela in Spain. When the Archbishop arrived in Dublin in October 1583, he was interrogated by the Privy Council. There he was wrongfully accused of many crimes. The Chancellor Loftus, who was also the Protestant Archbishop of Dublin, dealt with Archbishop O'Hurley in a kindly manner, trying to persuade him to become a Protestant. But the Lord Justice, Henry Wallop, addressed Archbishop O'Hurley in a savage manner, showering him with insults and threats. In later years, the Wallop family would be ennobled as Earls of Portsmouth. Interestingly, in 1897, one of those earls would donate the grounds of St. Aidan's Cathedral to the Bishop of Ferns. Over the course of the next year or so, letters were exchanged to and fro between the Lord Justices in Dublin and representatives of the English government in London as to how to proceed in the case of the Archbishop. These letters can still be seen as part of the state papers. The correspondence with Sir Francis Walsingham in London is of particular interest. The infamous Walsingham was the English government's chief spymaster. This is the same Walsingham whose deceptive behaviour did so much to bring about the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots. In a letter to Walsingham dated 10th of December 1583, the Lord Justices acknowledge a previous letter from Walsingham in which he, Walsingham, declares Her Majesty's pleasure for the proceeding with Dr. Hurley by torture or any other severe manner of proceeding, to gain his knowledge of all foreign practices against Her Majesty's state. The letter goes on to say that, "But for that we want here either rack or other engine of torture to terrify him, and doubt not, but at the time of his apprehension he was schooled to be silent in all causes of weight. We thought in a manner of so great importance and to a person so inward with the Pope and his cardinals, and preferred by them to the dignity of an archbishop, the Tower of London should be a better school than the Castle of Dublin, where, being out of hope of his Irish patrons and favourers, he might be made more apt to tell the truth, and therefore do wish that we had directions to send him hither. The Archbishop, however, remained in detention in Dublin. Wallop subjected him to torture in an effort to elicit a confession or to have him abandon the faith. The Jesuit writer Father Denis Murphy, in his book Our Martyrs, includes a written account gathered from eyewitnesses of the cruelties inflicted on the Archbishop. The executioners placed the Archbishop's feet and legs in boots filled with oil. They fastened his feet in stocks, and they put fire under them. The oil, heated by the flames, penetrated the soles, legs, and other parts, torturing them in an intolerable way, so that pieces of the skin dropped from the flesh, portions of the flesh from the bared bones. He who was presiding over this torture, not being used to such strange cruelty, rushed hurriedly out of the room, that he might not look further at such savage conduct, or hear the cries of the innocent Archbishop. Listeners should note that the cries of the Archbishop were not complaints, but pious outbursts such as, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." The state papers show that the choice of torture so inflicted on the Archbishop was that advised by Walsingham himself. The Archbishop was almost tortured to death, and at one point his tormentors thought that they had killed him. He was cast back into prison, and there his tormentors tried to revive him. A Jesuit priest visited him in prison, and with the help of medicines, restored him to health in as much as he could. However, it was a couple of weeks before the Archbishop could even sit up. His tormentors used many means to get the Archbishop to renounce his faith, but without success. They even at one stage sent his only sister around to him to persuade him to yield. However, the Archbishop was strong in his faith and expected no less from his own family. He told his sister to kneel down and beg pardon from God for asking such a terrible thing. After failing to elicit a confession from the Archbishop by torture, the Lord Justices in Dublin desired to have him tried in Ireland. They wrote to Walsingham in March 1584 that if Dr. Hurley should be referred to a public trial, his impudent and clamorous denial might do great harm to the ill-affected here in Ireland, who in truth have no small admiration of him. However, after taking counsel with lawyers, the Lord Justices were advised that treason committed in foreign lands could not be tried in Ireland. The law recently enacted in England allowing for such a trial did not apply to Ireland. The legal document with this advice may be seen as part of the state papers. Even though Ireland was a possession of the English Crown, it was governed by its own laws and customs. Thus, lawyers also advised that the Archbishop could not be sent to England to be trialled. As an Irishman, he must be tried in Ireland. The Lord Justices would have known that conviction of the Archbishop by ordinary trial in Ireland would be difficult in the absence of any proof of the charges made against him. Thus, in order to be sure of securing a conviction, the Lord Justices, or to be exact, Wallop, decided to have the Archbishop put to death in Ireland by martial law, and Walsingham was advised of this accordingly. Walsingham wrote back to the Lord Justices in the following month, April 1584, in which he writes of having spoken with Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth, and by her commandment writes that the man being so notorious and ill a subject, as appeareth by all the circumstances of his course he is, do proceed, if it may be, to his execution by ordinary trial of him for it. Howbeit, in case you shall find the effect of his causes doubtful by reason of the affections of such as shall be his jury, and for the supposal conceived by the lawyers of that country, Ireland, that he can hardly be found guilty for his treason committed in foreign parts against Her Majesty, then her pleasure is you take a shorter way with him by martial law. Walsingham concludes the letter by telling their lordships that Her Majesty cannot but greatly allow and commend their doings. Henry Wallop was soon to be replaced as Lord Justice, but he was determined to put the Archbishop to death before he left office. In actual fact, he carried out the foul deed just 2 days before he left office. Here is how it happened. Sometime in June 1584, we are not sure of the exact date, but the warrant for the execution was issued on the 19th of June. The Archbishop was put on a hurdle and taken out of Dublin Castle to the place where he was to be executed, just a short distance away, probably in the area around the present-day St. Stephen's Green. He was taken out quietly at early dawn to avoid any disturbance in the city. Wallop himself led the way with 3 or 4 of his guards. Catholic prisoners inside the castle who saw the hurdle being drawn shouted out that an innocent man was being put to death. Their jailers flogged them severely to get them to be quiet. On the way to the place of execution, the Archbishop was met by only 2 townspeople. Remember, it was early dawn. And these 2 people, along with one of the Archbishop's faithful friends, accompanied him to the gallows. The Archbishop was hanged with a withe, a halter roughly made of twigs, whilst he prayed to God and forgave his tormentors. His killers buried his remains in the place where he was executed. However, his remains were later placed in a wooden coffin and buried near St. Kevin's Chapel in nearby Camden Row. Over the years, great numbers of people came to pray at the tomb of the saintly Archbishop, and many miracles were reported. On the 22nd of September 1992, some 4 centuries after his holy death, Archbishop Dermot O'Hurley, along with 16 others, bishops, priests, religious and laity, were beatified as martyrs by Pope St. John Paul II. Those beatified included our own 6 Wexford martyrs. So until the next time, this is Brother Solanus Mary saying thank you for listening and Ave Maria.
Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on our website to discover other episodes at franciscanvoice.org.